This is the Wisdom Podcast.
Welcome to the Wisdom Podcast. My name is Daniel Aitken, and this week we are joined by Ross Bolota Roshi. Ross is a Zen teacher in the Diamond Sangha lineage and teaches in the Zen group of Western Australia. He tells us about his journey in Zen practice, beginning with his studies with Robert Aitken in the early 80s, and shares with us his insights into the value of koan study. I hope you enjoy this conversation. What was your first encounter with Zen or Buddhism?
My first encounter with Buddhism was when I went back to university for the second time, and I did a stop smoking course because I was a heavy smoker at the time and was keen to give up. And the course with lectures on, you know, addiction and things like that, but they had some yoga breathing exercise where you had to block one nostril and breathe through the other and then change it over.
Nadi Shodhana.
yeah, correct. And then the sessions with the woman who was conducting the course finished with some Buddhist meditation. And that was really interesting. And I found my way to the Theravadan Buddhist group in Perth. And
was that meditation more like a breathing meditation? Do you remember what the Buddhist meditation looked like?
Yes, it was an ordinary breathing meditation. Pay attention to breathing in, pay attention to breathing out. It was perfect.
Yep. Yes.
And around the same time as I had started to go to the Theravadan group, I met a Polish double bass player who'd come to Perth and was playing in the arts orchestra in Perth. And as he put it, falling asleep between the bar lines. I was involved in doing lots of music composition and music impro, and he was a very, very good, fine, free improvising double bass player. So I used to pick him up in my Suzuki van with his double bass on Tuesday evenings and bring him over home, and we would improvise together, me on piano and him on double bass. And then he would drink a lot and critique my performance really savagely.
You were studying music at university, is that right?
I had studied music at university, which involved some contemporary music then, Cage, Boulez, Stockhausen, the people who were big in the 60s.
Yeah.
So I'd had that experience, and I'd then gone on to, after some years of 4 years of school teaching, I then worked for 6 years at the Hilton in Perth playing piano. Mm-hmm.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So this is the sort of background when I met Richard, and he had Tony Packer, who was Philip Coppola's student and then co-teacher, had come to Poland and had led a session in Poland, a seven-day intensive retreat, which Richard had attended. So we used to actually do Zazen together. I had been reading Alan Watts's book called The Way of Zen. I would drop my daughter at school, and then I would go home, read The Way of Zen, and then thinking, well, there's no Zen meditation instruction in this book, but I reckon it can't be that difficult. So I got the pillows on my bed, and I would sit on the pillows on my bed with my knees around my neck and try and do Zazen as I imagined it should be done. But when I met Richard, he said, you can't sit like that. You know, you have to get cushion like me, you know. And you sit like this. And he showed me how to count my breath, which was first practice in Zen. And so we would sit together, and then we were joined by another Polish Zen student called Jan. And So we would sit in Jan's place, which was right near the freeway in Perth, but we would do Zazen there in the mornings. And I got introduced to pain in the knees, smell of incense, and Richard's library of Zen books, including books like the Blue Cliff Record and Shibayama's translation of the Women Kwan, and books like that, which were deeply intriguing.
What was the scene like in Perth? It's good to have another Aussie on the podcast, by the way.
I tell you what, it's really nice talking to you.
And I'm wondering, what was the scene like in Perth in those days? Were there Zen centres around, or was it more like happening in lounge rooms like you're speaking of?
At this point, there was no Zen group in Perth. I mean, we didn't think of ourselves as a Zen group in Perth either. We were just sitting together. But when I went for my first session with Robert Aitken Roshi in Sydney in 1982, when I came back, I contacted a couple of people in Perth. Paul Wilson was one of them, Ron Cassiope was another, and then we started a little group, a sitting group, together. And that started with the standard cut glass bowl and spoon for to ring out the rounds of Zazen, you know?
Yep.
And we had to move a piano. It wasn't at my place, but we had to move the piano at Ron's place in order to get a space against, the, you know, to look at the wall. So, yeah, it starts very, very, this would have started in 1982.
Yeah, fantastic. So Robert Aitken had come to Sydney.
That's
and
right.
And that inspired you. So you went there specifically for that, or were you in Sydney? What was happening?
I had written to Philip Kaplow because of the contact with Richard. And Philip Kaplow said something like, I read your letter with more than passing interest, but because you are married and you have two children, this is not possible for you to come to Rochester and work here. But Robert Aitken is coming to the east coast of Australia. You could do session with him. And this is very generous. And so I went to the State Library in Perth and looked up the Honolulu telephone book and managed to get Robert Aitken's address. It's amazing when you really want to do something how resourceful you get. So I wrote to him and he said, sure, yeah, come across. And so I came across and did my first session with him.
Wow. And what were your first impressions of Robert Aitken?
He was a person of surpassing generosity. For instance, he would spend time with students who were doing their first session to get to know them before session.
Can you give us a little background of his role in bringing Zen to the West? Because the audience may, you know, of course the Zen people are going to know about Robert Aitken, but, you know, the general audience might not.
Look, he is one of the the primary teachers. He went to Japan. He struggled with the fact that teachers in several instances didn't speak English. He had terrible trouble with his knees. He suffered from dysentery. Western students were fairly rare birds in those days in Japan. He, I think, found his true teacher with Yamada Roshi.
Yamada Koan.
Yeah, that's right. And Yamada gave him permission to teach, gave him a huge encouragement. And so, you know, a group had formed around him and Anne Aitken, his wife, in Maui. And Yamada would come over, I think on an annual basis, Roshi and Anne would also go to Japan and do koan work with Yamada koan. As a Western teacher, I think he's one of the greatest, perhaps.
Wow, yeah. Mm. And so when you met him, his generosity, you know, that was something that was very impressive for you. His ability to spend time, yeah.
He would give time, as I said, to new students. So I met him up on the balcony at Linfield where the Zendo was, and we sat up there, and I think he was quite shy, you know, so we both sat there looking out over the trees, and he said what was my sort of, you know, background with Christianity, and I said that I was congregational, I'd been brought up congregational. He said, so was I, you know, so there was a little bit of, you know, a little bit of a link. And
connection,
then
yeah.
Out of the blue, there was a long pause, and he said, you know, when Kumarajiva translated the Buddhist sutras from Sanskrit to Chinese, the Chinese didn't have a word for shunyata or emptiness. So what Kumarajiva did was to use the Chinese character for sky, ku.
Cool, okay.
Yeah, so this is very, like, it was beautiful. And then he said, long pause, and then he said, you should work with the koan mu.
Mu, yes.
And, you know, the little story that goes with it is the monk asks Chow Cho, who is the teacher, does the dog have Buddha nature or not? Chow Cho answers, mu, which means roughly, or sometimes translated as no, but more accurately is un, as in undo, untie. Yeah. You know, it's got that kind of inflection to it. Mm. But at the moment he gave me this koan, the koan mu, this dog came rushing onto the veranda and was running round and round us. And the sense of the synchronous and the synchronicity of that was just amazing, you know. So it was very uplifting, and we both laughed a lot.
Oh, what a wonderful first meeting.
Oh, it was just great. It was just great. Mm-hmm. And what I noticed with Robert Aitken is that when he met members of the Sangha who he knew in Sydney, and that he could remember the names of their children and their spouses.
Oh, wow.
And it was really touching to see how connected in he was. He was surpassingly generous to me as a student. I went to study with him in Hawaii, did training periods and all of that. Mm-hmm. And there, and, you know, he would offer extra doksan to me, and, you know, that kind of...
Very generous.
And what an you could always ring him. You could ring, you know, like you, at any time that was reasonable in Hawaii, you could pick up the phone and he would say, Roshi here, and he would talk, you know. He wasn't sealed off as a teacher from his students.
Very accessible. That's fantastic. And being having so many students, that's quite a commitment to make, right?
It is, yes. He had lots and lots of students, lots of overseas students, not just only in Hawaii.
So I wanted to, how long was he there for the first time in Sydney?
He would have been there for, say, 2 weeks. There was a week of 7 days sesshin, and I'd say a week around that.
So what was it like? What were you doing as a practice in that week for that first time?
I was working with the koan mu during that week, and there were probably 42 students. It was my first encounter with Zen as a formal discipline, a formal path. So I was introduced to chanting, to the agonizing practice of eating formal I can't think what the word escapes me at the moment.
Yeah.
Orioki, where yeah. you sit formally to eat, and after you've been yes. sitting for, you know, a number of hours, the agony was.
Yeah.
I can still remember it.
That made an imprint. So I'm wondering, like, so your first encounter with Buddhist meditation was breathing meditation, right?
It was.
And then you're introduced to Zen and how to sit, and then also you meet Robert Aiken, and then this you're given this koan, and there's this like and then the dog comes, and so there's this like experience you have, and then you say that. So then you were there and you worked with the koan for 2 weeks or whatever,
for a week. Yeah,
for 7 days. Yeah. So then I think people can imagine like in a retreat where you're going and meditating on the breath, right, for a week.
Mm.
But what does it mean to work with a koan like this for a week? What are you doing?
Mm. Yeah. Basically, you breathe the koan, and you ask the question, what is mu? So breathing mu, asking the question, what is mu? And you simply continue to do that. It's very, very, very simple very, very challenging.
Yeah, and it's a very personal experience, it seems.
It is. I mean, the process of that is becoming intimate with the koan.
Mm.
And you do through that process of staying with it. Also, the question itself raises your inquiring spirit.
Yes.
I think for myself, my earlier encounters with koans through, you know, reading the book, you know, the standard books like the Women Koan, the Gateless Barrier, the Blue Cliff Record, I loved the mystery. I mean. I was absolutely intrigued and entranced by it. I mean, it made no sense, but there is something there, you know?
yeah.
I think that sustained me.
Yeah, and I wanted to, so then you have this week retreat, and then you go back to Perth, I'm imagining. And then how do you take that practice back in your daily lay life, for example? How did you take that practice back?
Well, it's very easy to walk and breathe mu. It's very easy to walk and ask the koan. There is this, Robert Aiken used to talk about islands of practice. These are times of the day when it's very possible for you to return to practice, and even though the returns are brief, a brief return can also be very deep. And so, you know, taking the opportunity when you, for instance, while the computer is booting up, while washing hands, or while walking up a corridor to another room, or crossing the car park. All of these are opportunities to return to the koan.
Mm-hmm. So this is like the islands of practice. Is that what you said?
Absolutely, yes. Kensho is seeing into your true nature. Kensho is a little bit like honeymoon in relation to the marriage. Kensho is just the beginning, but it's...
Yes.
So... And you work with a koan like mu, or who is hearing that sound, or the sound of one hand, or who am I? These are called Dharmakaya koans, or koans of emptiness. And these are koans which are used to invoke that experience.
Yeah.
The group of koans is what is called the first barrier, and with my, you know, with the students who I teach and with koan work, they pass through all of those koans, but usually there's one of them is an initiating koan in terms of seeing into the true nature, and then the other ones kind of are also worked with. So it's a very, it's a fairly steep path, but
yes.
So there is seeing into true nature, which is Kensho. And then there are subsequent koans to widen that aperture. You know, like you see a little bit. It's a bit, the old analogy is like you, like clearing the corner of a window. And you can see a little bit through that corner. With subsequent koan work, you start to clear more and you can see more sky, if you will. And then the koan path works in that kind of way. Some koans are to move people on from Kensho so that they don't get attached to that experience and get stranded there. But generally the further koan work is to embody that experience and subsequent experiences to learn a kind of expression for it as well. Even though it's beyond words, there are ways to convey it. There is also the matter of, with the experience of Kensho, you are not bounded by your skin and your skull. And that openness, the sense of separation between oneself and the world, at least momentarily, comes down. Some subsequent koans are also there, called koans of differentiation, that it is still true that that you are Daniel and I am Ross, you know? That remains at the same time. That remains true. So
that's not invalidated,
that's
right?
That's not invalidated by that experience at all. So some koans are geared to that. And ultimately, with the koan path itself and its means are all forgotten, and you simply live your life, you know, without attachment to the path that you have taken.
Very nice. Thank you. You mentioned that Kensho is like the honeymoon, yeah?
Sure.
And so is that the, yeah, and then the marriage, what is there a word for the marriage, or is that the living of the life that you just mentioned?
It's funny, you know, students talk, you know, after Kensho and that, about being married to the way, you know? It's like that
marriage sense, to the way.
There is no going back. I mean, I know you can get divorced and all of that stuff, but in some ideal way, there is no way back from there. And I think all of the koan work, you know, after the first barrier, if you will, is the marriage itself. And learning to actually take that experience into your life and to live it, I mean, is so important. Otherwise, you just people sit around in cafes and talk about their experiences or something like that, and that's absolute poison. It has to be integrated and forgotten. Mm. That's the word I was searching for before. You have to
integrated and forgotten.
Yeah,
because when something's really integrated, it is in a way forgotten, right?
It is indeed.
Yeah, that's nice. And you, when you say overcoming the first barrier, is like that's related to the Kensho, right? The overcoming the first barrier and the Kensho, yeah.
Yeah. The first barrier is all concerned with Kensho and the checking of that experience. Although everyone realizes in different ways there are features in common.
The checking is the interplay with the student and the teacher?
Is
that the checking process?
Look, when the experience is genuine, when the experience is genuine and the student comes to you, in a way, nothing needs to be said. And yes, check-in can feel like a formality. Yeah, it's just a formality.
Yeah. Yep.
But sometimes it's not so clear, and the check-in is helpful, and
So there was another teacher that you worked with, John Tarrant.
That's right.
So I was hoping you could talk a little about John Tarrant, and then how you met, and what influence he might have had on you.
Absolutely. I was in Hawaii when I met John, and John was senior student of Eken Roshi at that time. And I was there for John's first session as a teacher. Robert Eken was sick. He had a lot of problems with his lungs, and he got really ill, and John took over and led the session, and I was into koan study at this point, so I met John when I'd been, I suppose, I was 2 or 3 years probably into koan study. John was very inspiring, and Robert Aitken came to Perth in 1985 and 1987 to lead Sushin.
Mm-hmm.
And John came in 86 and then in 88 and all the way through to 92 to Perth. And he took me through my koan work. He was really inspiring. He brought me a whole lot of great books. Every time he would arrive with another book, you know, like the record of Dongshan, for instance, Powell's book. They're all up on my thing. The Book of Serenity. I've got a whole bookshelf of books from John here. The record of Lin Chi, and you know, all of the great classics, and he was ardent as a teacher, and fantastic teacher for, you know, for doing the koan path. I remember going to Rottnest Island. And we were reined in. There are lots of Zen students about being Zen stories about being reined in or snowed in or and all of that. Yeah. But we went there, and we went through the Blue Cliff Record, reviewing the Blue Cliff Record, that's one of my vivid memories of John, is just sitting there in this cabin with the rain beating down, you know.
sounds beautiful.
Yeah, no, it was wonderful.
Part of the tradition.
yeah, absolutely. No, he was inspiring.
Now, and I understand John Tarrant teaches koan in a sort of unique way, like he does it more public as well, right? As well as teaching privately, which is different from his teacher, like how Robert Aitken would do it. Can you talk a little bit about the different styles? Because I know he's definitely known for that, right?
Yeah. I think I'm a bit of a traditionalist. I like the, I like it as a private matter. I mean, I give teishos and talks on koans all the time. Including a whole series I've been doing on Western koans, but I don't tend to do koan responses in a public way. I kind of like the privacy of that.
And John gave you John Tarrant gave you transmission, right?
Jointly with Robert Aitken and John Tarrant.
Okay, great. And what does that mean then? What does, in the Zen tradition, what does it mean to receive transmission from your teacher?
It means you're on your own feet.
You're on your own feet. Good luck.
Yeah, good luck. Very much. what does transmission mean? It's often expressed as, in terms of the senior teacher, like Robert Aitken or John Tarrant, and me, who was a junior teacher, and there's 5 years of apprenticeship, minimally before transmission. So it's said that senior teacher and junior teacher are of one mind is the kind of formal way of expressing that.
Nice.
It means that you are ready to teach. On your own, taking full responsibility. There are some formal things like you can do jukai with students, which means that you can students can take the precepts with you, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there are formal... Sorry, go ahead.
No. I was wondering what does precepts mean in the Zen tradition?
There are... The precepts are, you know, there are 16 precepts called the 16 Bodhisattva precepts. There are the precepts of taking refuge. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. The three pure precepts, which are, I vow to keep all precepts. I vow to practice all good Dharma. I vow to save the many beings. And then the 10 grave precepts, which I take up the way of not killing, not stealing, not misusing sex, not speaking falsely, not praising myself while abusing others.
Mm-hmm.
There are 10 of them.
Yeah, nice.
Not indulging in anger, not defaming the three treasures, not being stingy about the Dharma assets. Not sure if that was 10, but there are 16. It's a beautiful ceremony that you get to do, you know, with the person who's taking the precepts, and all their friends, companions, and the family often all gather for the ceremony, and it happens at the end of a 7-day sesshin, so you've got all that jariki power, you know, behind it as well. It's great.
That sounds awesome. That sounds awesome. And so as a teacher, it seems like you find a lot of joy in leading students through their koan practice and things like that. I bet that's very rewarding for you.
There's nothing like it.
Yeah,
I mean, it's impossible to really describe the affinity, the intimacy. And I think, until you teach yourself, there's an old saying, I think, until you have a child, you don't understand fatherly love, which is as it comes from the Zen tradition. But, that feels somehow at the core of it. It's hard to put into words.
And how have you found, like, transmitting Zen to the West, to lay people? How are you, what are the particular challenges you find for your students? You know, they're not monastics, they're lay people. How are you, advising them to approach Zen in Perth, Australia?
Yep. I think that the biggest... Look, I think having a busy life is not a problem. In fact, I think Zen thrives in busy lives, and this includes relationships, along with work. And it's almost, with some of my students, it's hard to see how they can possibly do it, but they do. the main problem is finding enough time to do Zazen. But I think that someone who is determined, someone who loves the way, will at least find an hour a day, even in the busiest day, an hour can be found.
Mm-hmm.
And my feeling is that if you sit an hour a day, you have a 27-hour day. If you sit for 2 hours, you have a 31-hour day. You know, that's how it works.
You find more time.
Yeah.
gives back, yeah. and then they're finding these islands throughout the day that you spoke of.
Yeah.
To come back to their practice, yeah.
Absolutely. And in some cases, the jobs which they actually do, the work that they actually do as teachers, for instance, they are able to embody the practice in their own teaching, for instance.
Yeah.
Working as psychotherapists or... I think what is absolutely key, I think a totally fundamental in terms of living the way, is the ability to listen. And Zen is great for this. So... when we do Zazen, the eyes are not shut, but you open them slightly. The gaze is down. Normally, sitting people wear black. The visual realm is somewhat backgrounded in the practice, but the oral thing, and especially through koans, like who is hearing that sound or what is the sound of one hand, the whole matter of hearing and listening is huge, and all the signals.
Wow!
All the signals in Zen are conveyed through sound, through bells, through clappers. There's not a lot of verbal instruction in that. So, I think this encourages deep listening. I think this transforms people's lives.
So then, this is in your practice as well. You're facing a wall normally in Zazen.
That's right. Yeah.
Then in some others, Zen, they face the middle of the room. Is that just two different traditions? Or
Both. We use both. Facing the wall is largely a Soto practice. I think facing in is Rinzai. When we do ceremonies, we face in. Normally we sit facing the wall. In particular venues, when it's difficult to face the wall or it's very, very cold and austere, we get people to sit facing in because it tends to warm the connection. Pretty flexible, but fundamentally the basic position is facing the wall,
Yeah, and then the visual sort of field goes into the background and you find the auditory, the audio field coming up stronger and... How interesting.
As a musician, of course, it's a kind of wonderful.
yeah, of course. And then the eyes aren't shut. Is there a particular reason for that then?
When your eyes are shut, you tend to...
more dullness.
Yeah, just dream, fall asleep. So having a little bit of the world, a little bit of input from the world is kind of good.
Yeah. So in this busy life we lead, making time, you think one of the biggest challenges is making time for those, those 7-day sort of retreat practices where you can get into the practice.
Yes.
And then we continue the practice by doing, the hour a day or whatever it is, and then returning to the koan practice or whatever your practice is through these islands throughout the day. It's a nice structure of practice to integrate and forget, as you say.
Well, yeah. 7 days of Shin is very important.
Yes.
It's intensive practice, but we also do one day retreats called Zazenkais, where we just gather at the dojo and sit for the day. There's a talk, there's Doksan, and we do a shorter Sesshin in summer, which is normally a 4-day Sesshin. And these formal occasions are really important for practice.
And the practice of koan practice is very conceptual in some ways. Like, it's interesting to me that there's this focus on audio, like the sounds, and if you think about thoughts and inquiring mind, it's more closely related to sound than vision, right? You don't see your thoughts, but in a way, you sort of can hear your own thoughts sometimes.
You can hear them. So, Yeah.
That can be a problem. But there's sort of a link. There's like a closeness. I don't know. I'm just playing here.
Yeah.
But there's sort of a closeness.
Sure.
With and so, you know, a lot of meditation practice is about finding stillness, right? First, before inquiring. So you're like settling the mind and developing concentration and then inquiring. And the koan practice seems to, you know, you're very straight into inquiring. Is that fair or not?
I like students to spend a considerable time doing breath practice and learning to settle before they do koan work. I'm not in a hurry to get people into koan work. My own experience was it was very rapid, I had been sitting for at least a year before that, both with breath practice, but with also my own invented koan. And, you know, I used to volunteer to look after people's places when they went away. And then I would install myself I'd take some rice and vegetables and I'd install myself for 5 days and sit. And I didn't know anything about kinhin, which is the walking between the rounds of sitting. So I would just sit.
Yeah.
And I had a 90-minute tape, and which I put in my cassette thing, and I'd recorded bells at each end of the tape. So when the bells rang to announce end of a 45-minute round, I just turned the tape over, you know, and then there were bells to start the next round. And I would just keep going until I couldn't go any longer, you know. I'd lie down and sleep. I was using koans in that context.
They were koans that you'd come up with yourself, right? Because you hadn't actually received koans.
Based on reading, inkling from things that I was reading. I wouldn't recommend them to students. But they were my own personal inquiry.
And now you're like, so you've got a new book coming out, The Crow Flies Backwards. And in there you talk about Western koans. Is that right? And so can you tell us a little bit about what that might mean and why that might be needed?
The traditions that come down to us from China and Japan tend not to deal with themes like love, sexuality, money, childbirth, the whole realm of life in the world in some ways. This is in no way to condemn the tradition. I love the tradition.
Yeah.
I love teaching it. This in no way is intended to replace it, but it's a way of just beginning to extend that tradition into some areas where it doesn't go. Another important theme in the book is the theme of time, and I've got a whole lot of koans around that. Not that that's not represented in this tradition, but it just adds a little bit of weight, mainly because I think in the West we're very concerned and anxious about time.
I think that's fair. And so who would these koans be for, or who is this book for? Who are you writing for?
I'm writing for anyone who's interested in Zen, basically. Because I think the book, the early chapters, spend time talking about the nature of the koan. It's quite a graduated introduction into the book. And I think that it's a book that can be approached by anyone who is fascinated by Zen. Mm. But it's also for students who've worked with the tradition and are keen to extend that. I mean, people in the Sangha in which I teach, in the Zen group of Western Australia, a lot of people in the group contributed koans, for instance. So the book, ways, is a celebration of them. And the first koan in the book is "Who am I?", which is universal rather than Western. But it will do for a start for a book of Western koans.
For sure.
Then Heraclitus is, "You never step into the same river twice, for fresh waters are always flowing upon you." And, ones like that.
Beautiful.
I
want
to, I wanted to. Can I read you one from one of my students?
I'd love to.
This
I'd love
is
to hear
one
that
I particularly like. this is Phil McNamara's "How to Catch a Fish." When I was young, my uncle would take me fishing along small creeks. The streams would mostly dry up in summer, except for a couple of pools. I had many questions about the wonder of those pools. I was told that they were unimaginably deep, and that though divers had gone down to find out why the pools never dried up, the bottom had never been reached. I could see they were not wide enough for a submarine to explore. But I imagined that even a submarine would never reach the bottom. My uncle said that the best fish lay in holes deep in those pools that never dried up. I was too scared to ever swim in them like he did, but I like to imagine that one day I'd get a fishing line long enough to catch that fish.
How to catch that fish.
How do you catch that fish?
How to catch the fish with an infinite fishing line, and that's at the infinite depth.
Absolutely. So that's one of the Beautiful. That's one of the koans in the book. You know, that's
Beautiful.
Yeah. So and there are 108 koans, which has all kinds of Buddhist significance, and and I do commentaries on about 40 of
nice.
Those.
So you guys working with those koans now, as like you would work with the traditional koans? Is that the idea?
I get my students to work
yeah,
with
the koans.
Yeah,
that's excellent, right?
I have been working a lot more since writing the book with the koan "Who Am I?", which is really efficacious, because the standard worry about using the koan, using the koan "Who Am I?" as a first barrier koan is that it's normally assumed that people will get terribly psychological about it and will get involved in all kinds of psychological byways, but my experience of working with students is this is simply not the case. And I think it's particularly efficacious and an excellent way in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's hard to know what the word is because there is no causal connection. If you will, eliciting Kensho or invoking Kensho, whatever, I'm not sure what word to use, but it seems particularly fine for Western students. So
is what you're saying, you don't normally draw a causal connection between the koan and Kensho. Is that what you were saying?
Yes.
Or is that just too intellectual for missing the point?
Oh, no. Look, it's just that it doesn't feel causal, even though a student is working on a particular koan. Kensho doesn't feel like it has a causal connection to the koan often, you know?
Yeah.
Kensho is Kensho.
Yeah. You walk into a room, but your walking into it didn't create the space in the room.
Exactly.
Like that.
Yeah, actually, it's a fine analogy.
It's these things are very interesting, very nice. But I guess the point is to experience them, and then you don't need the explanation so much. Right?
Absolutely. Once you've experienced it, doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. Fantastic.
Yeah.
So is there anything else we should cover? This has been a fantastic, enjoyable conversation.
Oh,
thank you so much.
I've enjoyed it immensely. Thank you. I think the effects of long-term koan study are often not talked about. We talked earlier a little bit about, you know, you integrate it into your life and then it is forgotten. And that's very important. But I think the feeling of long-term koan work, if you like, the kind of phenomenology of it, is it feels like your life is let out at the seams. I think that sense of humour is enhanced through koan study. I love it that Zen is so open to, you know, especially the Chinese traditions, you know. And I think that I also think that the Chinese tradition and Chinese koan tradition that Australia is close in spirit to, you know,
the larrikin nature.
Absolutely.
I think that a lot of the old Zen masters, when I hear about them, they feel like real larrikins, right? Some of the stuff they got up to.
They indeed. Absolutely, yeah. And it feels like, yeah. It feels quite Australian, yeah. I don't know, to me.
Yeah.
And, yeah. But I wanted to say that I think that, this is probably long-term practice, not just long-term Kahan work, but I think one ends up not sweating the small so much. It's not that one is immune to pain or one is immune to the pain of insult or that, but I think that it's easier to move on. Maybe even be a bit creative in some of these situations where one may formerly have been demolished or furious or... So there are all kinds of changes like that, I think, that come. And I think that it's a way of tapping in an unsentimental way, the wellsprings of compassion. I mean, you know, you look in the face of another, in a way you're seeing your own face, that kind of compassion. And so, you know, I think these things are important. And
how long do you think, like, the practice, like when you say long-term practice, when do you start, like, I get a real sense of freedom and spaciousness, and within that spaciousness a type of creativity to respond to difficult situations. When you're working with your students, how much practice till that starts to, you know, become a part of their life? And it's probably different for different people,
yeah,
I imagine.
Think so, but, you know, Zen is very slow, very, very slow to operate. So, you know, I think 20, 25 years, if I speak from my own experience. But one notices changes earlier than that.
Yeah.
I remember, I want to give one example of this.
Yeah, no, I'd love
this
to.
Has been probably about 5 years into practice, I suppose. And I remember I used to run these impro workshops for children, and we'd take 70 kids to the bush for a week. And they would do unicycling and music impro and the game called Exquisite Corpse, which is cut up poems, you know, like you don't see how it is and the poem emerges right at the other end, you know, from being folded and cut. All kinds of circus skills, amazing kinds of things. And it was just, it's tumult for a week. But you emerge out the other end, you feel like you've been in Sashin. The two things are identical, from the silent retreat and the retreat of tumult. But I remember that people, this was back in the 80s, and people sent their children to the camps, probably with different expectations, like some to, you know, to free up their trombone playing and to get them to improvise and all of that. Mm. And others probably had more conservative expectations. But I remember at the end of the camp, this woman came up to me and... she was just furious with me, and she said, you know, he has not learnt a single piece during this whole 7 days. And I can remember I can remember at the time, but being able to be, you know, like to say, oh, I'm really sorry to hear that. but being able to ride it, whereas formerly I might have got tetchy or, know, with her or, but, and I think that ease, you know, comes, I guess, from practice. It's, I mean, it's a little
ease.
Thing.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
And I think families tend to notice the changes perhaps before we do, and friends tend to notice the changes before we do. And
No, that's nice. And I think it's really nice for people to hear you know, from teachers, these sort of like experiences they've had, because it's very inspiring and very encouraging, especially when you're looking at like, you know, 10 years, 20 years of dedication to a practice. It's nice to hear these stories and also see other students around you and how they change in the world as well. So that's very nice. Thank you for sharing that.
Oh, sure. It's one of the wonderful things about teaching is noticing these changes over years for people. And yeah.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for coming on the Wisdom Podcast. It's been so enjoyable.
Great to meet you, Daniel, and thanks for your questions and encouragement.
I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Next time on the Wisdom Podcast, we are joined by Marcus Perman, Director of Research for the Sadra Foundation, in advance of their upcoming Translation and Transmission Conference.
So, of course, you know, Sadra Foundation had connections to particular teachers at first, but kind of the whole point of Sadra is that we are an independent entity, and our neutrality is one of the core strengths that we have moving forward. And the idea that Eric had really is to engage in strategic philanthropy with Buddhism, to support Buddhism in the West. And we, over time, it has become a really, there's been a real ecumenical approach, non-sectarian approach, where all traditions are supported. We have translators translating works in all the major traditions. And so it wasn't like it was about supporting just, you know, people that have been through a Kagyu three-year retreat. But there was definitely the recognition that we want to support scholar translators, people who have developed, ideally, real wisdom and compassion